This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Back in 1999, Von Hernandez, a former literature professor from the Philippines, successfully led the campaign in making the Philippines the first nation in the world to ban waste incineration. For that, he was honored with a 2003 Goldman Environmental Prize, considered to be the Nobel Prize for grassroots environmental leaders. In 2007, Von was named one of Time magazine's Heroes of the Environment. These days, though, he's at the forefront of the movement to break away from the use of plastic, and I find out more about his previous work and also his current role as the global coordinator of the Break Free from Plastic movement. Welcome, Von. How are you today?
Hi, Juliet. Thank you. I'm fine, and I'm happy to be part of your program.
Yes, thank you for joining us all the way from Manila today. Really appreciate you taking the time. So, Von, maybe you can tell me, how did a literature professor become an environmental activist?
That's a long story, Juliet. Actually, the jump from being academic to an environmental activist was made possible because I was doing a lot of volunteer work for various environmental and health-oriented groups while I was teaching at the university. And it so happened that in 1991, there was an extreme weather event that hit central Philippines, probably the first instance of extreme weather that we've experienced in this era. And it was a typhoon that brought in heavy rains, and there was deluge from the mountains in that city of Ormoc, and that unfortunately decimated about 8,000 lives, swept to the sea. And the day after, we were deployed to the area to help in the rescue and rehabilitation operations. And I was, to me, it was a shocker to be, you know, pulling bodies out of the mud and, you know, taking them to a common, shall we say, graveyard.
Yeah.
And for me, that planted in my head that, you know, this is something that happened because of, you know, years of logging in the mountains, and then, of course, just total disregard for the environment. And I made a decision then, that I wanted to be more involved in environmental activism. That was my turning point.
Okay. What a way to, yeah, I mean, what a wake up, I suppose, if you want to call it a wake up call, you know, having to deal with something so traumatic. But one of the things that you focused on then was waste incineration. And when did you first realize that waste incineration was a problem in the Philippines and also in other Asian countries? You know, and I think you discovered there was a pattern of dirty technology transfer from developed to developing countries. When did all of that come into your knowledge?
That's right. That was in the early 90s, towards the mid 90s. And at that time, we were seeing a wave of hazardous waste shipments being transferred from what we call the OECD, or the developed world, the developed countries, going to developing countries. And so we were seeing shipments of lead waste, or really hazardous waste, being shipped from the US, from Europe, from Australia, to Philippines, Indonesia, many places, to India here in Asia. Mm. And presumably taking advantage of what we call the path of least resistance, because it was getting more expensive to deal with those hazardous waste generated back in Europe or back in the United States. And because of increasing public opposition as well, they were finding escape valves towards the developing world. And it's as if, you know, a toxic effluent pipeline has been created, you know, to deal with the hazardous waste generated in the industrialized world. So it was a pattern of those hazardous waste shipments. And actually that gave rise to what we now have, which is the Basel Convention that stopped the flow of hazardous waste shipments of going to developing countries for dumping, direct dumping purposes. But there was a loophole, which was this recycling, that if you could recycle them, then they could be allowed.
Yeah.
And we are still fighting to make sure that that loophole is not exploited by unscrupulous interest. But in any case, going back to your question, so we saw this pattern of hazardous waste coming through from the developed world, but not only hazardous waste, but also technologies supposedly to deal with these kinds of waste shipments, and incinerators being chief among those technologies being transferred. They were, these facilities were facing also increasing opposition in the West. In the United States, they built many incinerators, and they're being closed one after the other because of more stringent environmental regulations. Same in Europe and also in other places. And we've seen a wave of this dirty technologies then being sold or being offered as aid in the guy or as loans being transferred to developing countries. And the Philippines, we saw a wave of those proposals in the mid to late 90s, which prompted groups in the Philippines to come together and campaign against incinerators or waste incineration as a solution to our burgeoning waste problems.
So just to go on that point, you said that the way that it was brought here was under the guise of aid, did you say?
That's right. For example, in the Philippines, to deal with medical waste, the Austrian government supposedly, in the form of aid, made it possible this transfer of so-called incinerators or modern incinerators to deal with medical waste. So we inspected those facilities and found that they were pretty much nothing more than just, you know, burners with no pollution control whatsoever.
Oh my goodness.
They're like Mickey Mouse incinerators, if you may. Apologies to Mickey Mouse. But and really, the fact that they came in with no pollution controls was just a scandal, you know, that medical facilities supposedly concerned over public health had become the source of public menace. And we found the papers behind the transfer of those technologies where really it was a form of loans that the Department of Health and the Philippine government is still paying for to this day. And that was packaged as aid from Austria. We exposed it. Unfortunately, the deal was not stricken off, and we're still paying for a transfer that had never really worked, only created more problems for host communities. None of these incinerators are working at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So basically, they were brought over to the Philippines, and I'm guessing it wouldn't have been in Manila. I'm guessing it would have been in the smaller, you know, lesser well-known areas, you know, maybe with the less politically influential people lived?
No, not really. I mean, it was all over the country. There
all
were
over the country. Okay.
Hospitals in Manila hosting some of these facilities. We did test these facilities in the Department of Health, subsequently also did their own tests and found really scandalous levels of dioxins, which, you know, is one of the serious byproducts of incinerating waste. And who would have known that by burning waste, it would be creating the most toxic substance known to science, the dioxins and the furans, they are definite carcinogens. And not only that, we found heavy metals, lead, mercury, cadmium in the sample ash from these incinerators. And this information was kept away from the public.
And
we had to expose it. We had to expose it as, you know, a case of dirty technology transfer and asked the Austrian government to basically forego this deal. But this fell to deaf ears, unfortunately.
But you did initiate, you did lead a number of campaigns in the Philippines, you know, including the approval of the landmark laws like the Ecological Waste Management Act, the Clean Air Act. I mean, what were you up against, you know, when you were trying to achieve this? You know, I mean, maybe in terms of, you know, the political opposition and things like that.
Yes, in around 97, 98, the Clean Air Act was being debated in Congress. And the Clean Air Act, which is one of our, what we consider one of our landmark environmental laws in the Philippines, carried important and restrictions, for example, against the use of lead in fuel, in gasoline, So, and we also, because of this onslaught of incinerators being proposed all over the place, we work with some legislators, with some progressive senators who understood the dangers that associated with incineration, and therefore they introduced a prohibition or a ban on waste incineration.
Right.
And this was, of course, carried through eventually in the Clean Air Act that was signed by the president at that time. And how we did this was, of course, an inside-outside, a combination of inside and outside strategy. So outside, we were working with communities who were being targeted to host some of these facilities. We were working with a Catholic church. We were working with allies in academia. And at the same time, there were people who were concerned with the issue of lead in fuels. that we combined forces and generated more than a million signatures that was then delivered to the House of Representatives, and they heard the message, and eventually that incineration ban was carried through. So you have to understand that there were these various proposals coming up in many cities, many places all over the country, and what we did was simply try to connect all these fights, all these local fights, and made it into a national issue.
Mm-hmm. And you organized mass protests against this. You even made the controversy into a national electoral issue back in 1998. What do you think inspired the people to, you know, to go to the streets with you and, you know, to manage to get it to that level, a national electoral issue?
It was quite a challenge. And you did ask me earlier what were the challenges or the, you know, obstacles confronting us. I mean, the industry was really against this.
Of course.
And you had chambers of commerce, chambers of industries, European chambers of commerce, American chamber of commerce, the Asian Development Bank, all saying, no, you must not discriminate against one particular technology. And you had foreign embassies, particularly governments who were sponsoring, who were promoting this kind of technology. And you have to understand, Juliet, it's not a technology that's being, it's not just technology that's being transferred, but it's a basically a linear model of development, right?
Yeah.
Where you get extract resources from nature, you convert those resources into products, and then the products become waste, and the waste has to be dealt with. It's a linear process where at the end of the day, the options being given to us would be either to bury or burn the waste.
Yeah.
Right. So and incineration was being packaged as a modern solution. But and that's the reason why, you know, many of these Western governments were also promoting this kind of model to developing countries. And unfortunately, we have fallen for it. Right. And
yeah.
We're still trying to extricate ourselves from this kind of linear model, when in fact we should be talking about how we bring back resources or waste, how we convert it back into resources along the lines of a circular economy, which is now getting more action. And in terms of the question, how we made this a national electoral issue in 1998, it was presidential election. Of course, we had been organizing together with allies in the Philippines what we call the Green Electoral Initiative. Essentially, this would be a list of issues, and we were asking the presidential contenders what their positions were on this issue. So one of them was on waste management. And the winning candidate then came with a commitment that to support a ban on incineration, mainly because of the anti-environment, anti-people consequences or implications of the technology. And when he became president, he had to honor that commitment, and he had to sign that bill into law when it came to his desk.
Well,
that was in 1999. That was President Estrada.
President Estrada, okay, Joseph Estrada. And, well, I mean, the ban has remained, or was it ever contested? You know, did you ever have to, you know, go back to court and fight this or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been contested pretty much since it was signed into law up to this day. I mean, we have not stopped it. People, and the funny thing is, those agencies were mandated by the law to implement this ban, you know, were the very same ones who are been busy trying to undermine or circumvent the ban. Let me explain. So after we won the Clean Air Act in 1999, we followed it up by campaigning for the passage of the Ecological Solid Waste Management Act in the Philippines, which we consider another landmark piece of legislation. And this was to ensure that while we were banning, for example, incineration as a solution, we were creating the space for the implementation of real solutions to the waste crisis,
yeah.
Particularly source segregation, which is pretty much spelled out and outlined in the Ecological Waste Management Act, and then the creation of what we call material recovery facilities. The intention is, of course, to approach this problem from the front end by investing in community education and organizing systems at the community level. We should be able to find rational solutions to the waste problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the different components of the waste stream, 50% of it is really organic waste. So the food waste and the biodegradable stuff. And that if you're able to separate that and come up with a strategy to deal with that, you would have solved 50% of the problem already. You yeah. don't need to landfill it. You could either send that to a composting facility and for an agricultural country. Of course, that's gold. You know, you could use that to support an organic agriculture agenda,
yeah.
For example. And then for the rest of it, like, you know, the paper, the plastic, the metal, the glass, if you're able to really separate that at source, you'll be able to create livelihood opportunities for each component of that waste stream. And like I keep saying, you know, waste is a verb. It's not a noun. It's the act of mixing all this stuff together that renders this whole materials set of materials as waste. You know, and once they're mixed together, the conventional approach is either, okay, bury them in a landfill or burn them in an incinerator, and you create other problems with that,
yeah.
With that kind of approach. So that was what we wanted legislated, and we got it with the Ecological Waste Management Act. And that same law also carried, or shall we say, reinforced and revalidated the ban on incineration. Unfortunately, since the enactment of these two laws, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, the lead agency tasked with implementing this, has been quite remiss, I should say, in implementing the laws faithfully. In fact, in the case of the Clean Air Act, this agency, the NR, has been sort of, you know, busy trying to undermine or reverse this ban on incineration by creating all kinds of guidelines to allow the operation of different variants of incineration. The most recent, of course, is what they call waste to energy.
Mm.
You know, this is a way that they're trying, the incineration industry is trying to repackage itself, that not only are you able to burn or get rid of your waste problem, but you also create energy. It sounds wonderful, right?
Yes.
As a proposition. But in fact, what you're doing is you're creating pollutants, you're creating cancer-causing pollutants in the process of burning. And at the same time, it is a waste of energy. It's not a waste to energy. It's, because by destroying these materials, that forces society, or that forces us to really go back into primary processing, extraction, manufacturing, distribution. And you can imagine the amount of energy expended is just, you know, several times over than if you would just simply recycle the material in the first place. So this is how the industry has repackaged itself, and the government has, in fact, the current government here in the Philippines, trying to implement some guidelines to create incentives for waste-to-energy facilities. And there are also attempts in Congress at the moment to rescind the ban on incineration. So really, the campaign has not stopped on the part of these proponents.
Okay. So that's, oh gosh, you thought that battle was over. I guess it never actually ended, did it?
Never actually ended. And I think the important thing is you just need to keep proving that the solutions, what we call the zero-waste solution, works. And that's what we keep trying to demonstrate, working with communities and working with enlightened local government units.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see that it's working, then they see that there's really no need for an incinerator. And in fact, even the need for a landfill is questioned, even a landfill of a big size, of a big magnitude, to deal with the waste. And these are the kind of solutions that we need at the moment.
I'm speaking today to Von Hernandez. He is the global coordinator for the Break Free from Plastic movement. So far, we've been discussing actually his work, which got him a Goldman Environmental Prize, which is to ban waste incineration in Philippines. We'll continue our discussion after this quick break. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. On the line with me from Manila today is Von Hernandez. He is the global coordinator of the Break Free from Plastic movement. And we're discussing the work that Von does. He is a former literature professor who has now become an environmental activist. He's been doing it for many, many years now, and we're discussing his work. And Von, you know, earlier you mentioned, despite the ban and, you know, how people are using the law in the Philippines, the recycling industry, they're using the law which says that homogeneous sorted waste for recycling can be shipped to the Philippines. And that's kind of, you know, providing a loophole for smugglers, you were mentioning?
Yes, indeed. And we've seen several cases of waste traders or illegal waste traders taking advantage of that loophole. It's a loophole that's also provided for in the current Basel Convention, you know, because Basel Convention, the Philippines is a signatory to this convention. It allows the transboundary shipment of hazardous waste if they are bound for recycling. And that's what the loophole that many traders are taking advantage of. So we've seen instances of, you know, mixed waste, clinical waste from Japan being shipped to the Philippines, misdeclared as, you know, plastic waste. Also from Canada, about more than 2 years ago, 60 container vans of, you know, so-called recyclable plastic waste. And then it was open, it was really just mixed plastic waste, including diapers, for example. So, and those containers are still sitting in our ports, and we've asked the Canadian government to take them back. Unfortunately, Canadian government has not acted responsibly on this issue and has refused to take responsibility over this fiasco. Meanwhile, we took this case to the courts, and the courts have issued a directive that the waste be taken out of the Philippines. But, you know, the government itself, Philippine government itself, I think, has not been serious in taking this matter up with Canada. And that's the reason why, you know, we still end up being a destination for all kinds of waste, not just hazardous waste, but also mixed plastic waste. Recently, the Chinese government declared that it was, you know, sealing off its borders from so-called recycled plastic waste from the Americas, from the U.S. and from Europe, which means that, you know, those waste collected in the richer countries will be finding their way in other countries, in Vietnam, maybe in Malaysia, in the Philippines, in Indonesia. We've already seen them spilling over to Indonesia, and also seeing increasing cases of such shipments here in the Philippines. So if your government is not serious about, you know, closing or sealing off its borders against this type of shipments, then it will continue to happen following the so-called path of least resistance.
Yeah, so basically, you know, our countries become, well, dumping grounds, isn't it, for all sorts of different waste which the other countries don't even want to deal with.
Yes, and they're using the under the guise of recycling, you know, and people think recycling is good when in fact it is being misused. And actually, it's a myth, you know, not everything can be recycled.
Exactly.
And a lot of it just ends up in the landfill, or if there's a burner, or if there's openly burned, as we've seen in Indonesia. We've also seen it in some parts of the Philippines, even if there's a prohibition against waste burning.
Yeah.
And the rule should be that if you generate this waste, it should be dealt with closer to the point of origin. And the manufacturers should be made responsible. For example, and this is what we call the extended producer responsibility. Take, for example, electronic waste, because we've also seen a lot of electronic waste being shipped from industrialized or developing countries. And this electronic waste, when they're dismantled, they're full of lead, they're full of mercury. PVC that's been burned creates carcinogens like dioxins and furans. If we made the manufacturers of the electronic materials or products responsible, not only at the point of sale, but beyond the point of sale, right? So, meaning they're responsible for the fate of their products, then that would basically force a regime. They are when they need to pay attention to design. You know, how can they design their products in a way where they minimize, if not eliminate, the use of toxic or hazardous materials? And how can they design them in such a way they could be brought back in a neater fashion, as in, you know, circular fashion. So at the moment, there is no such compelling force on manufacturers for them to rethink how they design their products in this taking into account the ultimate fate of what they produce. And that's the reason why you end up with this type of shipments, and they say, okay, this stuff is going to be recycled, we collect them, but then when they get to the point of destination, they are dealt with in the crappiest way possible.
And I mean, that kind of brings me now to your current role, you know, because you're now the global coordinator of the Break Free from Plastic movement. And that's an issue as well. You know, the amount of plastic in our oceans, the amount of plastic that we're generating, there's just too much of it. It's very hard to recycle. But maybe first you can tell me about the organization of Break Free from Plastic.
Sure. Well, Break Free from Plastic movement was actually launched. It's a global movement, first of all. It's a global movement consisting of mostly non-governmental organizations, environmental groups, envisioning a future free of plastic pollution. Mm-hmm. We envision a future with an abundance of life, not an abundance of plastic. Yeah. It was launched in September 2016, so last year, in the Philippines. And since its launch last year, over 900 NGOs from across the world have joined this movement. And the movement, one thing that separates this movement from other similar, shall we say, formations, is that we are demanding massive reductions in single-use plastics. Mm-hmm. And we want to push for lasting solutions to this plastic pollution crisis, because it's not simply about calling for more recycling, greater recycling. Recycling alone will not solve the problem. Yeah. We believe that we need drastic and massive reductions in the amounts of plastic that are being put and deployed out there in the market. Just to give you some context, in the 1950s, you know, when plastics became vogue, say, you know, the miracle, the wonder material, about 2 million metric tons was produced. And then jumped to 2017. Now, the production is estimated to have reached 8.3 billion metric tons. Compare that with 2 million in the 1950s to 8.3 billion metric tons. Exponential growth, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the unfortunate fact is that all the plastic that has been created since the 1950s, or even the ones before that, are still with us today. And a significant percentage of all this plastic material that's been deployed to the market are really, you know, also single-use packaging, mm-hmm. you know, stuff that you use only once, but then will outlive you for about 400 to 500 years. It's simply mind-boggling that we have allowed this kind of system to happen. And now we are finding traces of the problem everywhere, in our drinking water, bottled water is contaminated with microplastics. Sea salt is already contains microplastics. And then we found in marine life and also mammals, we find traces of microplastics in our system. So we shouldn't be surprised if amongst humans, on top of the food chain, we have traces of microplastics in our system.
And I think recently you, the Break Free from Plastic movement, there was an eight-day beach cleanup waste and brand audit on Freedom Island back in the Philippines, where you are. What were some of your findings or conclusions from that exercise?
Well, that was cleanup, because we typically, you find these cleanups happening every year, right? And as if, you know, this will solve the problem of pollution of marine environment by plastics. And it's estimated about 12 million metric tons enter the oceans every year, mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, plastic waste. And that amount is expected to increase unless, you know, the problem is addressed in what they call the problem countries, mainly the countries in Southeast Asia, where they find studies say where most of the leakage is happening. Mm-hmm. And so we did a cleanup over 10 days in a place on Manila Bay. It's called Freedom Island. It's actually a Ramsar site. It's a critical habitat for migratory birds.
Okay.
But you find this place is just, you know, literally drowning in plastic. And so we, together with our coalition and allies in the Philippines, had done a 10-day cleanup, mm-hmm. you know, of one stretch of the beach. And we did a waste audit to highlight the kind of, you know, materials that we find in the beaches, what are those problematic materials. And then we also did the brand audit. By brand audit, we wanted to highlight and expose the companies or the producers responsible for some of the materials proliferating in our beaches, mm-hmm. and ending up in the ocean. So, and the results of the cleanup and the waste audit showed that about 50% of the waste we collected were really plastic waste. And a lot of these are single-use plastics, you know, the straws, the polystyrene or the styrofoam cups,
yeah.
Plastic water bottles. And then quite a significant portion of it would be what we call single-use, single-layer or multi-layer packaging, the sachets. Are you familiar with sachets?
Yes, Juliet? Of course. Yes, it's everywhere.
Yeah, here in Southeast Asia. In Europe, it's not so popular. nor in the US, but here in Southeast Asia, in East Asia, it is quite popular. It's part of the strategy of this fast-moving consumer good companies to target
lower income, right?
The lower income classes.
Yeah.
So we find a huge percentage, really, sachets. And our volunteers were able to collect about 53,000 pieces of these sachets. And we, of course, painstakingly went through each of the sachets and, you know, look at the brands. And the brand audits revealed that the top polluters are really multinational giants like Nestle, Unilever. There's also regional companies like producing Copico in Indonesia, and also Philippine consumer brand companies like Robinson's, Universal Robina, for example. So, but a significant portion of it is really coming from multinational companies. And so that was really the part of the objective, is to highlight the responsibility of these companies. The problem with this type of packaging, of course, is you cannot recycle them. You use them once and then you throw them away. And that's the reason no one collects them, because they are of no value. And therefore, they escape recyclers, they escape the system, and they end up in rivers, they end up in our oceans.
I'm just thinking, you know, as you were mentioning it, just looking at my office, the amount of sachets we go through in a day, because, you know, it's just part of our everyday consumption. Coffee packets, you know, sugar packets, whatever, you know, it's just such a common thing. And like you said, there's no one's going to recycle this. We just bin it every time, even though there are other options available. But I guess, you know, it's become such a easy way for people to consume things that, you know, no one even thinks about the end of life processes that are involved.
Exactly, and that's part of the story being propagated to us, you know, in these modern times, you know, to be able to live a convenient lifestyle, you need this type of material. But, you know, that's exactly the story we want to get away from. You know, using one product for a few seconds or maybe one time, but then it outlives you. It just doesn't make sense, you know. And that applies to straws, that applies to plastic bags, that applies to plastic cups. And we have to really look at, number one, maybe alternative materials that could either be composted or could be recycled. Although, of course, there's also a consequence involving the use of other materials. But, of course, anything that could be recycled or anything that could be composted would be infinitely better. And then, or looking at alternative delivery systems. How else can we get this without relying on a single-use problematic material?
Yeah.
Right? So I remember even before the era of sachets, you know, we had retail outlets and people could buy soy sauce or salt sugar in increments, you know.
This was
the retail system I grew up in.
Yeah.
And of course, that has now been completely overtaken by what we call the sachet economy. But see, because, you know, this was foisted upon us by these companies, you know. It's also good for their branding. They wanted to target the lower income classes and also help with their branding. And we are now facing the consequences of that marketing strategy. So we have now to bring the onus back to them and say, okay, please take responsibility for this mess. You know, you have created this problem. You have to help find a way to address this problem that is now threatening not only marine life, but also other life on the planet.
Yeah, because, I mean, more than just an issue of pollution, it's also, I remember you saying that it's also a social justice issue. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, well, who are primarily impacted? They say that by 2050, there'll be twice the amount of plastic than fish in the oceans. In fact, in one of our interviews in Freedom Island, when we were doing this cleanup, we spoke to some local fishermen who were already telling us that nowadays, whenever they cast their nets to fish in Manila Bay, they will find 50%. Can you imagine 50% plastic? So already their livelihoods are impacted. And they say, of course, they're not the ones who are, you know, buying this stuff and polystyrene boxes. We don't have the money to buy this stuff. So, but they it affects the livelihood downstream. So, and then you have the waste pickers also, because there's perform a very important environmental function, right? They try to retrieve the materials that are of value and they bring them back into the productive economy. But unfortunately, because our officials are so fixated with modern quick fixes to the problem, they would rather burn or bury everything. This the livelihood of this waste pickers in the front line are also threatened, when in fact we could basically organize the system better in such a way that is safer, it is more acceptable and more decent for people to be recovering materials instead of, you know, working in a landfill or working in a dump site. That's not the way to go. That's where it when it begins to impact on people's livelihoods, that's when you find that there is a social justice issue to this. And while the companies are saying the sachets are for the poor, when in fact the impacts are also felt mostly by the poor. And we're not even talking about flooding, we're not even talking about the health impacts of finding all this plastic contamination in our water, in our bodies. I think the consequences are just we're just beginning to uncover the consequences.
So, you know, it's been said that the real solutions to this crisis, I mean, besides just making the production companies, you know, come up with better solutions and, you know, not using single-use plastics and disposables, zero-waste cities, you know, that has, and those sorts of practitioners and communities throughout the world, those are actually leading the way in, you know, finding a real solution to this crisis. For those of us who don't know, you know, how do zero-waste communities actually work? You have alluded to it in, earlier.
Yes, zero-waste cities is definitely the way forward. The fixation is not on on a disposal practice like incineration or landfilling, but rather how you are able to bring back materials that are properly separated, bring them back into the productive economy. Mm-hmm. So by investing in the front end, like for example, educating communities, organizing communities, setting up facilities like material recovery facilities, you're able to divert the waste that is generated at the ground level, away from landfills or away from incinerators. So it's really waste diversion approach. Instead of sending them to a disposal or a destruction site, you send them to a recovery site, you know. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the secret is in having a system that is built on waste segregation. And then you'll be able to find a rational approach. Before, it's not recycled, not everything can be composted. And it is that fraction that probably needs to go to a landfill temporarily. But at the same time, you point a finger at the companies who are responsible for manufacturing the non-recyclable, non-reusable, non-compostable stuff and challenge them that they have to design this stuff. I mean, that's the strategic direction of all this, really, is to challenge design. The design decisions being made by companies. But for those currently implementing this approach, like here in the Philippines, we've seen many communities, whether that's an urban poor setting or rural or a rich community setting, adopting this approach and succeeding very well. One shining example of how zero waste approach really works is in the city of San Fernando, which is the capital of Pampanga province in the Philippines. And here is it's your medium-sized city. And they invested in a zero-waste approach more than 2 years ago. That meant organizing the communities, the barangays, we call them in the Philippines, and then setting up material recovery facilities. And since they started this approach, they've been able to divert more than 80% of the waste that typically ended up in their landfill, in the dump site or the landfill before. There was a proposed waste-to-energy incinerator in the city that they never got to use because they never found a need for it after implementing the zero-waste model. And so by diverting 80% of their waste away from landfills, that meant also big savings in terms of, you know, their expenditures. Typically, your waste management budget is at the top of your expenditure as a local government. They're able to divert also the use of those resources and shifted them to public education, shifted them to public health instead of waste management or waste disposal. Now, that is a really elegant outcome of this process. At the same time, this approach has generated hundreds of jobs for local communities. It's good for the economy, local economy. It's also good for the environment. So that is the kind of solution that we need in this time. It's not more landfills, not more incinerators, but really more community organizing and public education on the front end.
Yes, and I remember speaking to someone else also from the town of Kamikatsu in Japan, actually, and they too have very successfully transitioned into a zero waste city. And like you said, you know, it's created new job opportunities. They got the community buy in, and you know, now they're just like another successful model of this. So it's not an impossible thing to do.
It's not impossible, so long as you set up a system and the system and the people see that the system is working.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Kamikatsu is like a waste is a drop in the country where you have so many incinerators. So it's almost like that positive experience is negated by the system that is dominant currently in Japan. Yeah. But we find in places like the Philippines and Indonesia, there are communities starting to build zero waste models. And in fact, the city of Bandung in Indonesia is really interested in transforming itself into a zero waste city. So Break Free from Plastic, together with our allies in the region, are working with the city of Bandung to mainstream this kind of approach.
Okay, and I know, you know, from like small little organizations in Malaysia as well, you know, trying to promote the zero waste lifestyle. There's a whole movement, you know, saying "tak nak straw," which means don't ask for a straw. You know, trying to get rid of people's, you know how we just take a single use straw like it's nothing. Sometimes we take more than one. So, trying to change people's mindsets. You know, these small community movements are kind of sprouting out. So I guess that is a bit hopeful.
It is hopeful, but we need more action, especially binding action. We've seen in many places, in France, for example, has banned the use of disposable cutlery, which is really it's tremendous, you know, in terms of the signal that it gives out. And also Kenya, Rwanda has banned plastic bags with stiff penalties. So we find this type of interventions to be more effective, and they will be needed. We need more of these initiatives in the future. Otherwise, voluntary approaches will not be enough. We need really drastic action conditioned by this type of prohibitions.
Okay, all right. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Vaughn, but what message would you like to leave us with and how we can get involved in this Break Free from Plastic movement?
Certainly, there's a hashtag Break Free from Plastic. Listeners can visit our website, and if you want to join, if you want to be part of the movement, and you'll be receiving our updates, our regular newsletter in terms of what's happening in many parts of the world and how you can be part of the solution. And of course, while we are all participating, we are all participants in creating this crisis, we can be part of the solution, and we can demand accountability from those who have profited or benefited most from this crisis.
Okay. Thank you so much, Vaughn.
Thanks, Juliet. I'm happy to have been part of your program. Thank you.
I've been speaking to Vaughn Hernandez. He's the global coordinator for the Break Free from Plastic movement. And we've been discussing his work, you know, which was previously helping to ban waste incinerators in the Philippines, an ongoing battle, as we find out. And now his current role as global coordinator of the Break Free from Plastic movement. And we've been discussing how we can all get involved with that. This has been Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.